You just start talking about the bill.
Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We will begin today by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 192, which we have heard before, and we'll be giving it some more discussion today. So, Day, you want to introduce this bill?
Chair Wernick, members of the committee, as you recall, Senate Bill 192 creates historic property partial tax exemption, and also it establishes initial 15-year period of partial tax exemption, after which property owners continue to receive partial tax exemption at lower percentage. It authorizes recertification for second period of partial tax exemption. It permits application for participation in historic property partial tax exemption until July 1, 2025. It restricts second 15-year term of historic property special assessment to commercial historic properties and to residential historic properties located in areas where governing body has authorized second term for residential property. It reduces application fee for participation in historic property special assessment program, creates indeterminate period partial tax exemption for historic properties that have completed at least one 15-year period partial tax exemption. And it also extends existing historic property special assessment program from June 30, 2010 to July 1, 2025.
Okay, we will start with a panel with Senator Walker, John Tess, and Roger Roper. Senator Metzger, did you want to join this panel?
No, I'll come back.
Okay.
It's hot in here, Madam Chair. thank you. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, and you're right. We've been here before. It's like a do-over, like Groundhog Day, but we hope that we've got it right this time. I am here as a member of the Historic Property Task Force that was created as a result of my bill in the 2007 session. Here this bill is, Senate Bill 416. I still have the bill file with all the goodies in it. And this is the new bill file along with my notebook. I will tell you that we're up to only the Dash 2 amendments, and we don't own the Dash 1, so I'm not taking credit for creating an amendment that I don't have any responsibility for. But in last session, Senate Bill 416, we were up to the Dash 10 amendments, and one additional was made in the House. So we're actually doing pretty well, considering that this bill has a lot of parts to it. Let me say that one of the things, Madam Chair, and you're quite familiar with this bill because you were on the committee last session, and you had expressed some of the same concerns that I had. And there were three things that we were trying to do in this bill, which was accountability, simplification, and effectiveness. Now, I reviewed Senate Bill 416 from last session to see what our charge was, which we know what it is, but I just wanted to refresh it. And it was simply that we were to review whether the program should be extended beyond 2010, which, if we don't do anything, it will expire. And we were also to assess the merits and shortcomings of the program and make recommendations for removal or for improving it or eliminating it. And then there were a whole set of things that we were to discuss. And I believe that you will be hearing from Mr. Tess and Mr. Roper about how we have addressed those things, such as effectiveness, the application fee structure, administrative costs, the accountability of the program, the administrative rules surrounding the program, the role of local governments in the program and the fiscal impact on those governments, the economic impact in our communities, the role of the program in relation to other historic preservation programs, the complexities of multiple owners, that would be the condo problem, and boy, if we fix that one, the negative impact on program participants when they exit the program caused by ballot Measure 50, and any other concerns that we came up with. We have done a great deal of work, and you'll see that in the Dash 2 amendments. I will also tell you before I get started that I pulled this out of my file. It was an Associated Press article, Portland makes list of 12 towns dedicated to preserving history, from 3/30/08. And the National Trust for Historic Preservation gave awards to 12 towns across the country for their commitment to historic preservation and community revitalization. And Portland, touted as a big city with a scenic small town feel, has won one of those awards. So it is important to the city of Portland, as well as the rest of the state of Oregon, for historic property preservation. We have met with the assessors on many occasions. We've met with our task force. In fact, after our task force, we invited the assessors into our task force to work with our organization, to work with our group. They have never been excluded. In fact, there's been an assessor on our task force from the get-go. The apparent roadblock for proceeding, I guess, has been from Multnomah County, who has expressed a little more concern than the Assessors Association. I will tell you that we've met with Multnomah County on several occasions, not me personally, but they've been to our task force and met with the chair of the task force, Mr. Test, and Mr. Roper, and they've met at length. So I'll let them talk about what they'd like to talk about. I will also tell you that Annette Spickard, who is the president of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, had sent a letter to you after the last hearing saying that the organization is not opposed to the concept of the Historic Property Special Assessment Program being extended to any date. Their concern was that they wanted to remain in dialogue with us to make sure that it met with their needs. Their role is not policymaking. She indicates that very clearly, that their organization is not a policymaking body. They are merely here to assist us in drafting legislation that works for the state of Oregon and works for them. And she indicated that their organization did not support the amendments by Multnomah County, other than the item that was related to administrative or technical implementation, such as the request for the assessor processing fee. And you'll see as the discussion continues that we have implemented a fee for the assessors for the extended period only, because there are many, many, multiple property tax programs that the assessors administer, and they do not charge a fee. So I think with that, I have actually pretty much covered what I wanted to cover, and we'll turn it over to Mr. Test to talk about where we are with the Dash 2s, and then Mr. Roper will go through the sections to just alert you to what each section will do. And so with that, I'll turn it over if you don't mind.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Tess. I'm president of Heritage Consulting Group. I'm also the chairman of the Task Force on Historic Preservation. I'm really familiar with this law. I've been involved in it ever since my professional career. I used to work for the State Historic Preservation Office in the 1970s, and I actually administered the law for the first number of years that the law was in place. The task force itself, you know, was created by Senate Bill 416 to create a comprehensive study of the special assessment tax law and to look at it and say, is it working, is it not working, and to respond to the concerns that were brought up in the last session, and also to look at the sunset. This is not the first time this law has been looked at. This law has come to you many, many times, the legislature. I mean, it seemed like it was coming every session almost, even though there had been sunset clauses and they were looking at it. In fact, there was a very technical review of the program in 1992. There was a governor's task force at that time. I was also on that task force, and we looked at the bill and we made some technical corrections at that time. I'm here today to support the Dash 2 amendments as proposed by the task force. I believe you should have a copy of those. The Dash 2 amendments actually implement the directives of Senate Bill 416 and are a result of a lot of hard work by a lot of people. The task force met many times, and we really had tried to address both urban-rural concerns, which has been an issue with this tax bill ever since its inception, the concern of the tax assessors as they were included both on the 92 task force as well as this task force, some of the inequities in the program, which included the condos. I mean, you know, I'm a preservation guy, but I mean, when people are paying, you know, very little or nothing on a brand new condo, I have my concerns too, and I think we've come to resolution on that. We also looked at other tax incentive programs that we were asked to look at. And we did study, looked at things from around the country and had people come in from back east. We had people from Resnick. We had people from, which is an accounting firm that deals a lot with tax credit programs throughout the country. And then we also had U.S. Bank come in and talk to us about different programs. Everyone was pushing towards a state tax credit. And we said, well, that doesn't work here. At least at this time, we're not going to be able to do that. So, based upon that, we moved ahead with continuing the program as we see it. There's been a lot of talk about what the bill should do, what the bill shouldn't do, or what it does or what it doesn't do. And I think if we just go back to the preamble of the bill, it kind of brings everything back into light, you know, and where we're at. And if you read that, and this has pretty much been the same as it's been since 1975, the first sentence says, the Legislative Assembly hereby declares that it is in the best interest of the state to maintain, preserve, and rehabilitate properties of Oregon historic significance. And this law has worked better than almost any law in terms of doing that from early on. It's one of the few programs that addresses residential properties as well as commercial properties. And it really was in response to things that were happening started in the 1950s with urban renewal and urban sprawl. And in the 1970s, where it was better to tear down a historic building because of the depreciation laws than to rehabilitate one. You could get money for, you could subtract the cost of demolition from your taxes, but if you decided to, and then depreciate a new building on the site, but if you decided to if you decided to tear down the old building, the only thing that you could do is subtract the demolition. I guess what you could say there is, you know, we talk about green and green movements. I think that historic preservation has been the start of the green movement and saving our built environment and saving, you know, being sustainable and things like that ever since that time. Being a resident of Multnomah County, I'm going to address things that in Multnomah County, because there are other people here that will address other parts of the state. And what I want to say is that when I was administering this program, it was amazing that as soon as this property tax law was put in place, you know, demolition plans for like the trolley building on the east side of Portland, the demolition plans for the New Market Theater in downtown Portland, demolition for the DeSico warehouse, buildings within the Skidmore Old Town Historic District, the Yamhill Historic District, all of these buildings, you saw very, very little demolition. And I was always amazed that the amount of savings was so small as opposed to the amount of money that you know, they would get if they actually tore the buildings down. So we did save those buildings. It was during this time, too, right after that law passed, that we had an economic downturn in the real estate market. And it was during that time that in Portland itself, most of the development that occurred along the light rail line, and it was the historic buildings that were rehabilitated. And it was because of this incentive, coupled with other incentives made available by PDC, as well as federal tax incentives that were available. Then later in the 80s, you have the Pearl District, and people have talked a lot about the Pearl District. Well, in the 1984 and in the 80s, there were plans to tear down 13th Avenue, the spine of the Pearl District. L. Solheim, and I have a letter from him that you should have, decided that he was going to make one building historic. They went ahead and made the whole district historic. It led to the initial development in that area, and today it finally grew into the Pearl District, and there will be other people talking about the Pearl District. But basically, there's 6,000 new housing units there and hundreds of thousands of office and other commercial space. All of this, what it equates to is that historic preservation and the use of this tax law, in fact, did act as a stimulus for economic development in that area and caused buildings to stay on the tax rolls and caused new buildings to go onto the tax rolls. And that's part of the equation that we don't hear when we hear people who are saying, you know, should we be giving these buildings a tax break? I've also included here, just, you know, because you can't talk about historic preservation without talking about pretty pictures. If you turn to your first area, the first divider, you'll see some buildings that I picked out. I tried to pick out things just all around Multnomah County, and then I have one building also from Washington County. But you have a mortuary that was rehabilitated by the McMinniman brothers, who have done 30-some-odd buildings. The Grand Central Market, many of you may have bowled there before it was rehabilitated, or many of you have maybe gone there afterwards. The Telegram Building, which I understand Venerable Properties will be here and speaking to you about that. The Brewery Blocks, and we have Mark Edlin, and he'll explain to you how that acted as a stimulus, but they didn't really make any money, and they, in fact, you know, ended up spending $750,000 to just hold up the chimney there and maintain that as an icon of the Brewery Block area. And then the Imbrey Farm, and I think that a lot of people have been out there for a hamburger or something and had a good time out there, or maybe a drink might be better. And is the law working? Well, I think you have to really look at, you know, the most recent project that's used this as well as five other sources of funding. The Meyer and Frank Department Store, that's the last picture that you have in your book there. Basically, what that did is it took a building that was not going to be, it was going to go dark because Macy's was leaving. Macy's was leaving the upper floors. They were able to put together federal funding through the use of new market tax credits, federal tax credits. They were able to use a special assessment. During the course of the project, they were able to create 1,000 construction jobs, and historic preservation is known as being more labor-intensive than other, and I think in these hard economic times, we do need jobs. And then it also created some 461 permanent jobs that will be there, and it created downtown as a 24/7 place in that area. It will also lead to development of other buildings in that area. Let's see. I think that what people really need to do is when you look at this law, and you have to realize that there is some ripple effect that happens, whether it be in Albany, where you redevelop the Three Rivers Market, or any small town or any small neighborhood where you need to have that stimulus to go. Historic preservation and the ripple effect that it causes includes the creation of jobs in town as well as good economies, creation of new businesses, which lead to more taxes, and the creation of new taxable property resulting from development of some of those vacant lots that you might have throughout the city. At the last hearing, Multnomah County tax assessors did come and offer some amendments that I believe are the -1 amendments. We've addressed their concerns. We've actually met with them on that. In your packet, I do have a chart that shows the existing laws, the law, what it is, what the task force is proposing, what the Multnomah County is proposing, and then some comments on the end. I don't propose to go through those today, but they're there for the committee to look at. We also addressed, and I think it was very important, and we spent a lot of time on this, was the condo issue. And I believe we found a solution. And if you go to the last attachment here, in your packet there, I'll kind of walk you through this. We make some assumptions because things change and there's different numbers that change, but this kind of grabs the essence of what the changes that we're making in Senate in our -2 amendments. You start with a warehouse building that has a real market value of $600,000. Prior to the special assessment, you have an assessed value of $400,000. After the rehab, you have a building that's worth $6 million, and you have 10 condos in there. And then we have the CPR and the tax rate. Under the current law, after you do all the calculations and you bring those buildings online, basically what happens is that you would end up with a tax bill for each of those condominium units of $400. What we're doing with the new law is we're saying that as each of the units sell, the assessor will go in, they will establish the real market value for that building, then they will apply the calculations that bring the value back down to their specially assessed value and then move forward. So what that does is it changes the amount of taxes you're paying from $400 to $3,000 per unit, which is still a little bit lower than what you would pay with a brand new house, but it's much more in keeping with what's fair. Also, for the total building, rather than paying $4,000 for the taxes, there'd be a $30,000 tax dollar bill on the on the building. What happens basically is that we're trying to treat each of those new units coming on board as an individual residential unit that might be coming on board. But at the same time, we don't want to penalize the developer for having done that and getting taxed at the new rate until he actually, or he or she actually sells the property. Do you have any questions? I mean, I'm happy to answer if that.
So basically, the $3,000 tax would be 3,000 times 10.
That's correct.
As
so
they each.
That's correct.
There wouldn't be additional property tax for the building commons or whatever.
Well, the building commons are actually included. You're paying taxes when you have a condominium. You're actually paying taxes. You know, okay. That $400 is included. I mean, that is included. The common areas are in fact included.
Okay.
So, in summary, the adopting the Dash 2 amendments will, A, simplify the program. The program, it needed technical corrections. This is not complex. It's long and lengthy because there had been so many changes over the years as a result of Measure 5 and Measure 50. But these are technical corrections, and it does simplify the law. Secondly, it makes the program easier to administer for both the local governments who become much more involved, the SHPO, and for the tax assessors. It also makes the program much more accountable, resolves the condo issue. It also has a provision in there that resolves inequities for owners who were impacted by Measure 50, and I'm sure that'll be addressed considerably more as people come up here. And it leads to the continued preservation and rehabilitation of our built environment. In short, I think that this law has set a national standard, when it was put in place. Today it's not, more people are going towards a tax credit. The law itself is not something that people are, as Roger will show you, is not something people are flocking to get, it's not for rich people, it's not just for condo owners, and it's not something that people are just getting a tax break. It really is for people who are intent on doing something because there's a lot of strings that come along with that. I've lived in historic houses, and frankly, I wouldn't want to go through having to. I used to review that stuff, and they review it, and I'm not doing it. So I'm going to keep my house the way it is. So in any event, I believe the Dash 2 amendments do everything that we were asked to from the last session, and we really did try to address the concerns of the assessors, which I think we did, because if you look at our task force report and look what we came out with, there was a big change since the last time, and we did try to address Multnomah County, and we had meetings with them and things like that, and we feel that we've addressed them. We may not agree, but we've addressed all of their issues. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Roger. Thank you very much.
Okay. Before you go on, I just wanted to ask, first of all, thank you for all your hard work as chair of the task force. But your company, what is your Heritage Investment Corporation or Heritage Consulting Group? What do you do exactly?
We are historic preservation consultants. I've been a historic preservation consultant for 30 years. I have an office in Portland, Oregon. I started in Portland. I used to have an office in Washington, D.C., and now I have an office in Philadelphia. We do this work all over the country.
And who are your clients?
Our clients are... they can be governments. We work for governments. We're doing some stuff for the Navy right now. We work for individual developers. We work for architects. We work for accountants. Sometimes attorneys will bring us in. I do a lot of work for U.S. Bank. There's a full gambit of people that we do, in fact, do work for.
But what's the nature of the work? To help them get the...
To help them make their buildings historic and to help them secure state or federal tax incentives that are available out there to rehabilitate their building, and then to make sure that the buildings are rehabilitated in a way that's proper and in accordance with the standards, the Secretary of Interior standards, because if you don't do it that way, then you're not going to be eligible for the credits. So that's what we basically do. We try to protect the property.
So and we have to disclose this as public.
Right. No, that's
but
fine.
You have, as well as an interest in historic preservation, you definitely
have
a business stake in the continuation of this program.
I do, yes.
Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Roper.
Madam Chair, could I address that as well, please? There were a number of people that were appointed to the task force to represent different interests with regard to historic property, and Mr. Tess is just one of those many people who represent the different interests, and he was appointed chair by members of the committee.
Okay. Mr. Roper.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Roger Roper, Assistant Director with Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, with responsibility for heritage programs, including this program. We administer this program and have done so for 34 years. And I don't want to repeat what Senator Walker or Mr. Tess have talked about, but I do want to talk about some of the mechanics of the program and of the Dash 2 amendments, which we support as a department and which has the governor's office support as well. And it's something we've been working on for a while here. I'll be talking off of the blue sheet that's in front of you, a couple of pages stapled together there. There's some bullet point items and then some other facts that I'll be referring to if you want to have that at the ready.
Thank you.
Okay. We do want to streamline this program. It's had a lot of things go on with it over the years, and if you look at the bill itself, the 35-page Dash 2 amendments, that's just a part of the statute, and so part of this has been trying to clean up a lot of things that have happened over the years. At the same time, to make it more effective of the program and to make the participants more accountable. So those were the main goals we were shooting for, and some of the components were in place, but we think we plugged in the other elements there as the charge of the task force was given to us. In the end, we would hope that we could create a very simple property tax incentive, but property tax is not simple, and we learned that. We ran into so many dead ends in trying to resolve things. And in the end, we decided, you know, the program as it is really pretty good in terms of the benefit it offers. We looked at other options of property tax reduction and other things, and we checked out what a lot of other states were doing and ended up coming back and saying, you know, what we have here, it's been around a long time, it's been modified, and it's actually pretty good. And one of the main indicators as well is that we see that it's not a big giveaway either, and that's a concern we've had, and I know everyone would, that this is just a tax shelter for people. But if you look at the participation rate, since the property tax reforms of the mid-90s, we've only seen 37 properties per year come on board with this program. So that's about one per county per year coming in and saying they want to meet the requirements and they think it's a good way to go. Prior to the mid-90s, and those property tax reforms, we were seeing more than double that. 82 properties per year were coming on board. So really the last 15 years or so, it's been pretty stable. And 37 properties per year, in the end, we thought that's not bad, and the benefit may be just about right. So in the interest of keeping things simple for the assessors and property owners, we're not tinkering really with the formula and the benefit. We think it's working fairly well, and we were actually, I was just looking at this letter that came in from the National Trust for Historic Preservation, an April 20th letter. They're the national organization that promotes historic preservation around the country. Their take on our program is, if you look on page 2 of their letter, they say it's a modest but effective program, kind of in the middle of the pack of what other states are doing. And that's sort of, that was what our research had come up with as well, so we felt gratified that they had confirmed that. And that's probably where we think we want to be with this. We don't want to be giving out an overly generous benefit, but we're glad there's something there that can help these properties move forward. On page 2 of my handout, a couple of other statistics for you. One is, of course, this property tax incentive is only available to buildings listed in the National Register of Historic Places. So there's an automatic gate there that only lets certain properties in the door. Property owners have to prepare a preservation plan. They have to follow through on it. And if not, they face some penalties. The type of property is about 50-50, commercial and residential. Give you some idea of the profile. In terms of reinvestment, this is important. Are people reinvesting in these historic buildings? Over the past 5 years, we've seen in commercial properties, $1.3 million per building on average is being reinvested in these when they come into the program. For residential property, it's just a little over $100,000. So again, those are averages over the past 5 years. And then if we look at Multnomah County specifically, they've had 106 properties come on board in those 5 years. The assessed value of all those collectively, $131 million, but $236 million is getting reinvested in that. So it's gratifying, at least from our perspective as an agency, to see that the program is attracting the kind of reinvestment and the revitalization that was envisioned back in 1975 when this program was enacted. Mr. Tess has talked about the solution we've come up with for the condominiums. We think that was a problem, and we hopefully this will solve it and resolve that issue. Another thing we've done with this is we have opened up the door for local governments to be more involved in the program. They're already conducting some of the reviews on historic properties. From our agency perspective, we're okay allowing the local government review to suffice for the review for this program as well, and it keeps the applicants from having to do a double application and eliminates confusion in some of the paperwork. So we've got some mechanisms in place that allow that local participation much more than they were in the past. We've got the bill, the 35-page bill, and I don't know if you want to address any of that. If you'll notice on pages 3 and 4 of my handout, I've tried to create a little decoder ring for you, essentially.
We appreciate it.
To be able to translate what the bill is really trying to do. And if you'll notice in the bill as well, Legislative Council was kind enough to leave our little headings in there, chapter headings, so that you can find your way around without having to just go by the section number alone. Of course, this bill only addresses the parts of the existing statute that are being modified, so this is not the entire program in total. It's just those sections being modified. I don't know, Madam Chair, if you want me to briefly introduce you to some of the key sections of the bill and point you to those, or how you wish to proceed at this point.
Why don't we have quite a few people signed up to testify. Why don't I assume you're going to stay here for the rest of the hearing?
Yes, I thought
and,
I would.
Why don't we take a hold on that, unless the committee, I'd certainly, if somebody wants to have him go through, I'd certainly be happy to do this.
Madam Chair, could I ask if Mr. Roper could at least discuss the extended period that solves the Measure 50 problem?
Well, actually, that was the one question that I had.
Right. He has not discussed that yet, and that is of particular concern to a number of legislators who have constituents who have been impacted. And I will tell you that the task force wrestled with that for months and months, and the solution that we came up with initially turned out to be unconstitutional. The some of the suggestions from Multnomah County about some of these programs were unconstitutional as well. So we have spent many hours with Legislative Council, with the Department of Justice, Department of Revenue, trying to find the way to solve this problem. Should you, and this is truly a policy decision, should you wish to solve this problem, the solution that we have that Mr. Roper can discuss with you is really about the only constitutional solution we could find, short of going to the ballot with a constitutional measure that would change ballot measure 50. And you know how difficult, that's as difficult as trying to run a tax credit program through this session, which is why I advise the task force not to turn to a tax credit program. So if Mr. Roper could at least address that before he steps down,
yes,
I think that
I'm
would
glad
be helpful.
You mentioned that. I was going to wait till after we heard testimony on it, but as a prelude to that, we had extensive hearings, this committee had extensive hearings in the interim on Measure 50, and we found inequities, just severe inequities. People who paid twice as much property tax, three times as much property tax as a similarly valued home in another neighborhood or even in their own neighborhood. And I guess the question I have about this category of people is why. You know, what's the policy justification for solving the inequities, the Measure 50 inequities for one privileged group and not solving it for everyone? Because the inequities are stunning. We had testimony from all over Oregon with people who, just because of when they had bought their house or sold their house, just through some coincidental thing, would pay four times as much tax as their next door neighbor. So the question that I wanted to get answered is why we should be so concerned about the inequity plight of this particular class of people when it's a plight that affects really all Oregonians under Measure 50?
Madam Chair, excellent question, and I guess the short answer is we were charged with addressing this through the Senate Bill 416 from last session. So we know it's a more comprehensive problem, something much bigger than we can tackle, but we thought for our own little corner of the universe, there could be a solution that would resolve it for this group of property owners. And what we developed was an extended period of special assessment for those property owners who are indeed harmed. And by harmed, I mean they get in the program, do everything they're supposed to, fix up the building, maintain it, and then when they come out, they're far worse off because they get reassessed when they come off the program. They're far worse off than had they never participated. So there's a disincentive for them to, and future applicants, to be involved in the program. So it really turns the program on its ear if this issue isn't resolved. It doesn't affect everyone. It really matters where you live and what the economy is doing at the time. So there's a very small number of people who may suffer from this, but their suffering is no less intense just because they're fewer in number. So this extended period would provide a much lesser benefit. It would be more in line with where they would have been in the tax rate, in the tax assessment, had they never participated. And there's a calculation that has been developed, and that is in Section 8 of the bill on page 14. This extended period is also addressed in Sections 13 and 14, talks about it a little more. And so these property owners could apply to get on that extended period, but they could also come off, and there would be a time we would expect where property owners would want to come off, because during that extended period they're getting a lesser benefit, but they're still having to come for approval on anything they do with their historic home. They're not off the hook in that regard, and they may tire of that over time and decide that maybe it's worth just paying the extra tax at a given year and come off of that. We do want to stress, too, that that option is not available for condominium owners. We think that's a special class of property that has its own unique issues and shouldn't really be part of this. It should be more for individual property owners. We think as well that the added work that this might require merits a fee for the assessor's office on these. We would not be accepting an application fee for administering these extended periods from our agency perspective, but it would be for the assessor for this extra term. So we're trying, that's the brainstorming we've been able to come up with, and with the best advice we've had from legislative counsel. We've run it by Department of Revenue to make sure it passed the smell test with them, and that's where we are with it. So,
is it true, and I haven't looked into the details, and you really have to sit down with someone with their property tax bill in hand to understand how it affects an individual. So is this something that affects all the participants in the program or just a few of them?
Madam Chair, just a very few. Many property owners come off the program and they just merge right back in, and some may be better off having been on the program because of the formula that has to be used constitutionally when they come off of special assessment. Mm-hmm. You run it through the formula. Some come out about
as if it were new construction.
Right.
Correct.
They come out about the way they would have been. Some may be lower and some are higher.
So you don't want to worry about the lower ones, you just want to worry about the higher ones.
Well, they're the ones who've come forward and created the issue. I suppose we could go back to the drawing board and
I think the
resolve
counties,
that as well.
The counties might like you to adjust the ones who come in lower. All right. Well, thank you for explaining that. We'll be hearing more about that, I'm sure. Are there other questions from the committee before we move to our next Okay, thank you very much. Now
thank you.
We have our First Lady here, and Senator Metzger is also here. Pardon?
Let Senator Metzger to go first.
If that's all right with you.
Brief. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. I was really fascinated by I'd like to know more from Mr. Tess about the rehabilitation he did at the mortuary. I hope it's one day when I'm in the mortuary that I will be eligible for rehabilitation as well. I think it's just amazing things that we can do.
I see a story for the Weekly Democrat.
Very possibly. Madam Chair, I got involved with this issue, and in fact, one of my constituents is in the audience, as Senator Walker pointed out, and Mr. Tess, because of some of the inequities that were created as a result of Measure 50, and it was very clear, as Senator Walker pointed out, and that was not an easy issue to solve because of the constitutional nature of Measure 50. So I just want to commend to the committee that this task force, and under the guidance of Mr. Tess and Senator Walker, has done a tremendous job. I know everybody who has their own little silo issue has their perfect solution for that particular one, but it doesn't solve then the overarching problems as well as what this task force has done with their Dash 2 amendment. I think it really, really, really improves the program. And to get to your question, as Mr. Roper pointed out, Senator Morris as well, is that the balance between trying to provide relief, especially on the Measure 50, is balancing this with the incentives of the program. When you talked about all the other issues that people with properties may be faced by that are certainly very true. But in this particular case, these incentives are driven for public policy, and that is to preserve historic properties. And so that's why, under this narrow scope, it's important that we don't want to totally disincentivize folks from preserving important buildings in our state. But I think they've done a great job on it. I thoroughly support the Dash 2 amendment. I really support the work they've done. And Mr. Tesson, talking about the property, I will agree. I got involved with it 3 or 4 years ago because of my constituents. And a year and a half ago, I too bought a home. It's the Constable House. It is on the National Register of Historic Places here, right one block off the Capitol Mall. And it is not in special assessment, and don't intend to put it in special assessment because, as he mentioned, it is a very complicated and restricting type of process. But for those who do, and if that is an incentive in order to do the repairs necessary to preserve important parts of our heritage, I think it's absolutely critical. And so I just want to commend to you their great work, and hope we'll be able to move this forward.
Thank you, Senator Metzger. Any questions? Thank you. Now, finally, our First Lady, thank you for your indulgence. Our Fourth Lady.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Mary Oberst, and I am the First Lady of Oregon. More important for today, however, I am a member of the Task Force on Historic Property, and I'm one of two Oregon advisors for the National Trust for Historic Preservation. And my position on the task force is as the trust's representative. You also have in your materials a letter from Dr. Anthea Hartig, who is the director of the Western Office of the National Trust. So we're double-teaming you a little bit today. Others, of course, have offered testimony about the particulars of the bill, but I just wanted to call your attention to some guideposts that we used in our work on the committee. As Mr. Roper mentioned, we did want to continue the property tax freeze program that was established in 1975. We wanted to continue it because, frankly, it works. It works and it puts people to work. Report after report shows that historic building rehabilitation stimulates local economies and enhances community character. And frankly, a restored building is the greenest building you can possibly find. So we also wanted to fix some problems that were brought to our attention in the 2007 legislature. Some of those problems were perceived and some of them are very real. One of the perceived problems is that only rich people in Portland use this program to fix up their homes. And as Mr. Tess and Mr. Roper suggested, in fact, in the last 12 years, only about 37 properties per year statewide have enrolled in the program. A very real problem, as you have heard and are aware of, is that property owners sometimes get caught in this Measure 50 morass and end up with a grossly inflated property tax bill. So we tried really hard to fix that. Our third guidepost was that we wanted to encourage participation in the program. And to do that, we wanted to ensure that our product was useful for commercial and residential properties and that it was fair and equitable. So we wanted a program that was streamlined from an administrative point of view for both developers and homeowners. We wanted a program that had good accountability, and we wanted a program that was not unduly financially burdensome in order to enroll, but also not unduly financially burdensome to the counties involved. We wanted something that was usable throughout the state. Last, we wanted to create a program that dovetails with some other initiatives that encourage private restoration and rehabilitation of historic properties. I'm thinking specifically of the Oregon Main Street program, but also some of the programs in the SHPO's office that offer technical advice for historic property owners and so on. I just wanted to basically come here today and assure you that this program isn't really a government giveaway program. It simply recognizes that historic buildings are special buildings, and they have special needs, and they're often in special places. So those buildings help create our unique sense of place in many of our towns and cities, but they are costly to maintain and restore and preserve. If we do things the right way, using the right techniques and materials, and if we enroll those buildings in this special assessment program, we can offset some of those extra costs and create jobs and create special business districts and some really great housing. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much for coming, and thank you for your long-standing service on the task force and for preservation in general.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay. We have four people who've come more than 100 miles. So I'm going to grab three of them here. Betty Tam, John Jodenberger, and Mike Ballenseifer.
Mike had to leave.
Oh,
he's a river pilot, and he was called to duty.
Oh, I'm very sorry. We always try to give priority to the people who've come a long way. I guess we just weren't quick enough this time. So while you're here, since we have a third seat, let's get Barbara Sidway up here, and then we'll have all our long travelers on the same panel.
Appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. Welcome to all of you. Who wants to start?
I guess I'll start. Thank you, Senators, Madam Chair, and members of the legislative hearing. I'm Betty Tam from Umpqua Community Development Corporation in Southwest Oregon. I'd like to thank you for listening to interested parties, and in this case, someone who has used the property tax freeze for historic properties. You know the general concept, and I'm here to tell you that it works, and to ask that you support Senate Bill 192-2. I live in rural Oregon, and my nonprofit company, Umpqua Community Development, serves rural communities throughout Southwest Oregon. In our area, some of the old and derelict but historic buildings are albatrosses, dragging down the whole community commercial center. Investing in their rehab can have a dramatic effect on the entire commercial district. Not only that, the tiny tax break can leverage huge resources. I have for you summaries of two projects that Umpqua CDC has done. Both have created affordable housing in city downtowns. To undertake an affordable housing project in an historic building or any building requires that we seek state and federal funds and we have to match the federal funds. Small towns often cannot afford to provide any kind of a cash match, so the tax freeze is painless and small in comparison to the benefits provided. The savings from the tax assessment is calculated as cash value as local match. I've leveraged this and other local resources of up to 10 to 20 to 1. The other thing about rural communities, the towns and developers are often not as experienced or sophisticated as large urban entities. So if the hoops are too large or too complex, it just won't happen. The DAS-2 amendment and the existing system is easy, yet it's not a large tax loss. I believe there is only an average of one project per county per year. we've probably done our share in Southern Oregon on that basis. As you can see from the examples I've provided, we've brought $5.5 million into Roseburg and $7.5 million into the city of North Bend. These are huge job stimulus options. The North Bend project is underway right at this minute. The downtown building is crawling with tradespeople, almost all local. We calculate we are supporting about 100 jobs for 16 months in this small town. We couldn't have done it without the historic tax freeze and other historic incentives. There are many ways to count the multiplier effect, 4 times, 7 times, whatever you count. These projects have a huge ripple effect in rural communities. The other benefit is the end result of the project. In each, we are creating affordable housing, both targeting mixed low income from the working poor to disabled vets and seniors. The Grand Hotel created 7 units and 5 commercial units. The North Bend is creating 33 residential and 3 commercial. For the affordable housing, the tax break helps us to keep the rents down over the long term and thus keeps the rents affordable for very low-income people. The Grand opened in 2004, and since that time the whole street has bloomed. Several adjacent buildings have been rehabbed as people decided it was worth it to put money into buildings adjacent to the Grand and increase the tax base for those buildings. So this single small tax assessment benefit has ripple effects in many directions. I suspect a small tax freeze pays for itself many times over. Those are large projects in small towns. I do also want to tell you that the tax freeze works for small projects. My husband and I own a historic building in a very small town, and we spent 5 years restoring it, a few $1,000s at a time. We couldn't have afforded to undertake the restoration without special assessment. We're ending up investing probably 10 times the value of the tax break, but it's spread over several years. Paired with that annual break in taxes is what made it possible. It's improved the appearance of a significant historic building in Oakland, which is Oregon's oldest historic district. So thank you for listening, and please do support 192-2. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Want to go next?
Yes. My name is John Goodenberger, and I'm from Astoria. I'm from a small town and would like to speak about how special assessment works in a small town, and then tell you specifically about some projects. I've chosen the commercial project simply because it was easiest to get the photos of for this presentation. But Astoria has been very mindful for years that historic preservation is economic development, and we started back in 1978 by establishing a Historic Buildings and Site Commission, which reviewed alterations to historic structures. Then we inventoried our building stock. We haven't even finished it in all those years, but we started the inventory. And since then, we have established 3 National Register districts. Third, the establishment of those historic districts provides owners of historic properties within those districts to apply for special assessment. I've counted, I believe, 37 applications from Astoria since the inception of special assessment. Along the way, we were told that this would kill the community, and it has done quite the opposite. We have had lots of investment. Astoria is blossoming. Special assessment, the preservation of structures keeps money local. Preservation money is spent on craftspeople rather than on materials. Materials are being shipped into the area. We're keeping the money local. It enhances our neighborhoods through preservation of its structures and encourages new investment. The derelict or underused buildings are placed back in the economy, providing housing, offices, or retail. And revitalized commercial spaces are attractive. This is what the owners who have gone through the process have told me. And tenants are more willing to relocate into buildings and pay more rent in those buildings that are rehabilitated because they want to associate themselves with those rehabilitated buildings rather than one that is run down or surrounded by those that are run down. And finally, tourism thrives on historic preservation.
The historic downtowns and residential areas are considered destinations for tourists, and tourists want to visit places with this sense of identity. Astoria currently will be receiving between 18 and 22 cruise ships in this spring and fall, and it's directly associated to our efforts in historic preservation, because we have used our identity. If you look at the first page, I have three photos of the Hotel Astoria. The photo up in the left-hand corner is a before photo back in about 1985, when the building essentially looked like a bombed-out shell. The birds flew through the windows. The boards on the lower areas were covering windows. People came. They purchased the building. They rehabilitated the upper levels for low-income housing and started to rehabilitate the lower spaces. This was before there was a great accountability in special assessment. And consequently, one of our county tax assessors became pretty angry that these folks were getting a tax break, because they really hadn't honestly fulfilled their duty to rehabilitate this building. SHPO staff came and provided the hammer to get more work done. The job was never finished. We currently have other owners who have now purchased it, who are purchasing buildings throughout Astoria because they believe in historic preservation, and they intend to submit another application and finish the job that was done. They are going into that with the understanding that they will probably lose money, but that historic preservation is important, special assessment will help them, but it won't get them there the whole way. On the next page, we see two photographs of the Liberty Theater. These are after photos. Once again, in the 80s, it went on special assessment, and it was fine for a while until a slumlord bought the buildings, who sat on the buildings, and there was really no accountability. Once again, the tax assessor became pretty angry about it and started to apply pressure. Well, the city couldn't do anything because largely the offenses were on the interior. SHPO was able to provide some of the hammer. Without SHPO's assistance, we would have lost the paintings that surround the theater. We would have had a damaged, if anything, existing chandelier. The chandeliers and light fixtures would have been torn down or sold. And so once again, SHPO provided service for us. Essentially what happened was that building became mothballed until a nonprofit could purchase the building and do the job that needed to be done. But SHPO, because it was on special assessment, was able to apply pressure to do minimum work and preserve some of the integrity of the interior. These are two pieces of why we now have more accountability. Because had they had more accountability to begin with, these buildings would not have taken so long to be restored. On the next page, we have the Hotel Elliott. It was essentially a flea bag. In our local fundraisers, there was kind of the standing joke that first prize is a night at the Elliott, and second prize was two nights at the Elliott. And so it was a flea bag hotel where nobody wanted to stay. It was a detriment to downtown. And so now it's been renovated into a boutique hotel. It has received national awards, one from the National Trust. When people stay there, I'm told that when they stay in the presidential suite, they say they've never stayed in anything like this in the entire world. And these are big business people that are coming to Astoria and dropping dollars and wanting to invest in Astoria. On the next page, we have the River Pilots, and Mike Balanciefer was one of the owners of that building, or that collection of buildings, the Calendar Navigation Company Ensemble. Three waterfront buildings. There were originally a blacksmith shop and a ferry landing, etc. And the River Pilots used that as their office. They were also using it as storage. Through special assessment, they were able to take those buildings and rehabilitate them so that they're now offices. There is a little coffee shop in it. There's a B&B in part of it where the old caretaker place for one of the River Pilots. It's still empty. Many of the places are still empty, but that's just simply an economic reality. But the building has been saved, and Mike will tell you that special assessment and the federal tax credits were the only way that this project would have happened. As a bit of disclosure, I helped Mike on the special assessment application. for that. And he has said that without that help, he couldn't have done it. If we make the application more complicated, people like the river pilots, particularly in small towns where there aren't very many consultants, are not going to be able to do the work. If you make it more complicated, I will make more money, but there will also be fewer applications. Okay. The last piece is a building which burned on Thanksgiving Day weekend, and it's a quarter of a block that burned this year. The owner is going to be using special assessment and federal tax credits to rehabilitate and restore that building. Once again, those are critical pieces to the rehabilitation of downtown Astoria, and without this, we would have abandoned buildings, and in this case, a hole in downtown. Thank you.
Thank you. I've stayed at the Elliott. A couple of us have, and it's a glorious place.
Good accomplishment. And it's hard to tell it was ever a flea bag.
Yeah.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Barbara Sidway. I may win the award if there is one for most miles traveled. I drove 350 miles to see you all today.
Oh my goodness. Well, welcome here.
Thank you.
And you can take a nap before you drive back.
I may well do that indeed. But I have to say it's wonderful to follow these two terrific people. I haven't met Ms. Tam before, but you don't know that I happen to serve on the jury that awarded the National Trust Honor Award to Umpqua Community for the wonderful work that you've done. It's national significance what they've been able to achieve in the context of the area down there. And Astoria is one of my favorite places, and just, you know, ditto on everything they said. So I am a task force member, and I was appointed to represent the interests of rural Oregon development interests and ownership interests. So that's my orientation. I have done properties on the tax freeze in Baker County as well as Yamhill County, so I bring that perspective. And Senator Telfer told me, I had the opportunity to see her last week, and she said, bring pictures. So I did. So you have this little sheet with a before black and white picture. And then you have the far more exciting after picture, which is here.
Oh,
so I want to just tell you about just one example, case study, if you will, and I will be brief because I know there are many people that want to speak, about how this can make a difference. The Geyser Grand Hotel is in the middle of historic Baker City, a wonderful late 19th century streetscape. Over 100 buildings contribute to the historic district. And right in the middle of it was this building that was boarded up since the summer of 1968. And we did decide to go forward with the restoration, and the building reopened in 1997. We would not have been able to go forward with it without this incentive program. Now, we've referenced in some of the testimony already that historic buildings are green and sustainable. I'd like to use this building as an example of what we mean by that. I have the privilege of another National Trust angle. I serve on the Board of Trustees for the National Trust for Historic Preservation. We're kind of everywhere now in Oregon, I think. And so I asked the folks at the new Green Lab that just opened in Seattle to calculate what would the energy savings be associated with the Geyser Grand retaining it, because you've got embodied energy in a building that you lose when you tear it down. Then you've got the energy cost to haul all of this stuff to the dump. Then you've got the energy cost associated with building rooms anew. So let's do the math and see where we're at. And that's in front of you here, and I'll just read through it for it really quickly. 80 billion BTUs embodied in the building as it was built in 1889, the equivalent of 650,000 gallons of oil would have been wasted. That's the equivalent of driving 15 million miles. Demolishing the geyser would have created 4,000 tons of debris, enough to fill 25 railroad boxcars, a train quarter of a mile long. And if a new geyser grant had been built, that construction would have released as much carbon into the atmosphere as driving a car 3 million miles. So it's really a significant public benefit that we all enjoy when historic restoration takes place. Private investment can be leveraged with this relatively modest tax incentive. In this case, more than $7 million in private capital, not government funding, was invested in this small community. More than 100 construction jobs took place in the 1994 to 1997 period, and there are 40 permanent jobs directly created. Before you get into the multiplier effect and whether it should be a high number or a low number, those are the numbers that I know and I can testify to you. Now, there's been great impact on the community that's deep and lasting and significant. Yesterday morning, a book was released called, Great Towns of America, and a distinguished urban planner named David Vocak did exhaustive work for years studying all towns across America. And you'll be wanting to get this book because actually 12 towns in Oregon made the grade, which is fantastic, out of 100. Baker City made the grade, I'm very proud to tell you. And when we spoke to the urban planner at the little press conference yesterday morning, he cited the Geyser Grant as the key factor in Baker City's emerging strength and being included in the list. And nothing to do with me personally. It had to do with the power of preservation to strengthen communities and anchor what's happening there. Tourism industry has really taken off. It's continuing a nice, strong trajectory, even in the face of this recession and difficult economic climate. Other private investment, significant and promised, has occurred in downtown Baker City. There's reduced property and personal crime. The police love the fact there's a 24-hour activity in downtown. And downtown property values have been strengthened. They have increased. And that translates to property tax revenue to our county. And that's just my brief testimony. I'd be happy to expand at length and take the rest of the half an hour, but I think that's probably not the right thing for me to do.
What half an hour?
Oh, I would like to just mention one thing. Since I'm a complete non-politician, I just can't help but recognize Earl Blumenauer and John Russell, and I think we should all be so grateful to them for having established this law 35-some years ago. And I think it's remarkable that my Senator Ted Ferrioli would be the first to say, this is great, and this works throughout my district. And so I think this is a truly bipartisan, good-for-Oregon program that really should be continued in the Dash 2 manner. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, questions for the panel? Thank you very much. Okay, now time limits are going to start because we're getting short on time. So the next three witnesses will be Ann Catlin, Mark Edlin, and Burr Boutwell. And I would like to ask you to keep your question, your comments very brief. And to, if you want to associate yourself with someone else's comments, feel free.
I'll go ahead and get started, and I'll try to be brief. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Finance and Revenue Committee. My name is Ann Catlin. I'm from Albany, Oregon. I wear a couple of different hats today. I am a residential property owner participating in the special assessment program in Albany. I work for the City of Albany. I'm the preservation planner for the city, and I also was honored to serve on the Gunners Task Force that evaluated this program. I feel that these Senate Bill 192-2 amendments are going to improve the program in many ways, and I hear firsthand from hundreds of property owners and prospective property owners how important it is to have an incentive program in Oregon to protect our heritage and our history. The program encourages the preservation and appropriate rehabilitation of historic properties. In Albany, in particular, many properties got on in the 1980s and 90s once our districts were established, and I can tell you these districts are very popular places to live, except my neighborhood, which is the up-and-coming district. But we are seeing tremendous support and good things happening, and the ripple effect is indeed alive in Albany. The program creates a positive partnership between the public and private sectors. Appropriate preservation costs a lot of money, takes time, and requires design and historic review. Most local governments do not have additional incentive programs available, and it's very nice as a local government person to have a carrot out there to balance out some of the sticks and the regulations. The program also fosters civic pride, promotes neighborhood and Main Street revitalization, sustainability, economic development, and you've heard those arguments, and I do want to say that Albany is also nationally known for our historic resources, and we are part of the Main Street program. As a task force member, I do want to say that we spent a lot of time discussing ways to improve the program and fix some of the shortcomings of the program. We worked closely with the assessors, especially Annette Spickard, and also representatives from Multnomah County. And together, everyone's input, addressing some of the tough issues like the benefit, how much is enough, accountability, unintended consequences, and constitutional challenges have resulted in a better bill, and that is Senate Bill 192-2. It is clear and easy to understand. It streamlines the program in a positive way. It addresses the condominium issues, and this will result in increased revenues for the counties. It also fixes the unintended consequences of Measure 50, and this isn't just a benefit for the few rich people. This is really something that is important to keep the program alive and continue participation in the program. And as noted earlier, it provides for more local government participation and oversight. And as one of those people that will be providing that, I welcome that, and I think that's a good amendment. No one has said anything about Senate Bill 192-1 amendments, and I do want to say a couple things about some of the specific proposals coming from Multnomah County. They agree with the many positive things with historic preservation, but they proposed a few things that in essence would make this, we'd get the whole bill and the program, especially for residential property owners. One of their proposals is to limit the exemption to only the value added due to preservation.
Excuse me, could you step back up from the mic
a little bit? It would limit the exemption to only the value added due to the preservation or rehabilitation, and it would require the applicant to prove that this program was needed for the restoration work to occur. Preservation is a very comprehensive undertaking, and when a building is designated historic, it's designated in its entirety. I wanted to give you an example of how many restoration efforts do not add assessed value. They do not require building permits. They do not necessarily result in a higher tax value. And yet these restoration efforts can change a neighborhood and start a ripple effect. And I do have some examples that follow visual examples.
You have those in your testimony, correct?
Yes, I do. So
I think you don't need to go over those. I think we have them here, if that's okay.
And just wanted to show you some visual pictures. But a person can spend $50,000 repairing dry rot, expensive painting on the interior and exterior, some plumbing upgrades, a new roof. Those don't require a building permit all the time. And the value has gone up, but from the assessed value standpoint, a lot of those do not trigger an increase in value. So a lot of work that would be undertaken by residential property owners would not receive any benefit under the proposal by Multnomah County. Oregon has a really rich heritage, fabulous historic neighborhoods and downtowns. It's a great place to live, do business, and come visit. Oregon needs and deserves an incentive program that works for all of Oregon to encourage preservation of our unique architectural resources. I think that the proposed amendments in 192-2 will accomplish those goals. And I did provide some pictures of some regular historic homes, not your big fancy homes, and some commercial properties in Albany for your review.
Thank you very much. Mr. Edlin.
Good afternoon. My name is Mark Edlin. I'm a member of the task force, but I'm here predominantly speak as a private developer today. I've also submitted a letter from the Portland Landmarks Commission in support of the task force recommendations. Our firm is recognized in doing sustainable mixed-use transit-oriented projects. We've completed approximately $4 billion worth of work. Historic preservation is a very small part of our practice, however, and that we find it is not something we can make an ongoing living at. However, we think it's something that's important in our practice. We believe historic buildings play a critical role in defining our communities. They're touchstones to our past and they're reminders of where we've come from, and they're very instructional to our children. Unfortunately, the redevelopment of historic buildings are extremely challenging. On average, when weighed against the equal-sized new construction, they usually cost one-third or more to redevelop, yet they attain rents that are typically lower, at least in our community in Portland, than comparable new buildings due to the lack of efficiencies in the layouts of the buildings. Equally important to people like us, and unlike renovations, new construction has a more predictable timeline for construction, a faster velocity, and fewer surprises. And to us, surprises mean cost. Usually the development opportunity for new construction is for a substantially larger project on the same site that a historic building might occupy. And with lower rents, it makes it more difficult to work, that make the project financially feasible. When combined, they create significant disincentives to save historic buildings. I'd like to focus on two of the six historic projects that we've done and my testimony here today that we've completed in the Portland area. The first is one that I understand is in contention with the perhaps others here today are testifying, and that's the Deschutes Brewery in the Pearl District. It's a one-story quarter-block building. It was built in 1919. A building housed an auto parts manufacturer and jobber business in a district once dominated by similar businesses. Under current zoning, we could have taken this one-story building and developed a nine-story building on this same site at a time when the market, unlike today, clearly supported larger and more dense development, whether housing, office, or other uses. Yet in our estimation, such a building located across the street from the historic armory where Portland Center Stage currently occupies, which we also completed, would have hurt the overall fabric of the neighborhood and of the district and the visual appearance of the armory itself. We were fortunate in the pre-development process to secure an anchor tenant that would lease the entire building. The cost of the renovation to our firm was approximately $5 million. Yet even with favorable conditions of having the building 100% pre-leased before we ever broke ground, our leverage return is 4.71%. Not exactly a get-rich-quick scheme. And all the while, the historic nature of the building created considerable design challenges. For example, we had to redesign the doorways at the southwest three times before we could get Park Service approval, while also navigating between the city, the Park Service, and whether there should be a mechanical screen on the roof. The only incentive from the city or the state had to offer was special assessment. That savings, however, served as a financial and psychological tipping point that allowed us to justify our efforts and our investment in the property. And now, with the complete renovation, rather than minor paint and plaster, which we see in many buildings in the district that are bulldozer bait of the future, those buildings are scheduled probably within 5 to 10 years to be taken down and see those nine-story buildings go up as opposed to long-term historic renovations with a Band-Aid approach, I'm proud to say the building will stand for another 100 years, carrying on part of the history of our city and our state. The second project goes back a bit in time, and you have to think backwards probably 20 years to envision this. It's hard to see that today. Today it's known as the Whiting Kennedy Building. Then in the late 1980s, when we came upon the building, it was known as a cold storage warehouse, and it suffered through three saw over decades of time. Today, some would say it's the center of Portland's creative industry in the center of our city. Previously, before we acquired it, it was a dilapidated eyesore in a neighborhood filled with eyesores. You have to think back, this is before the brewery blocks, before Hoyt Street, and before many of the other developments in the Pearl District. In many ways, the Wyden and Kennedy renovation was one of the critical renovations and keystones to make the Pearl District what it is today. At that time, it was the rail yards that were bisected by an old concrete viaduct, and when the city was spending thousands upon thousands of dollars, planning dollars, trying to figure out whether to install a train museum or aquarium to activate the district. In other words, there was no there. The transformation of the cold storage building and the Wyden Kennedy building was a transition point for the entire neighborhood. It located hundreds of jobs in the Pearl District and demonstrated what could happen. Its success played a defining role in our interest in undertaking the historic Blitz Weinhardt facility, the five city blocks, and redeveloping it into a mixed-use project, along with other projects such as McKinsey Lofts. I would argue that the redevelopment of the cold storage building into the Wyden and Kennedy building spurred another $1 billion of taxable development in the Pearl District that exists today. Without Wyden and Kennedy, maybe the Pearl would have happened, maybe it would have happened 10 years later, 20 years later, or maybe it wouldn't have been as dynamic as it is today, nor the economic engine is today. As a developer taking the risk that these projects require, I can assure you that special assessment certainly has served as a primary driver in giving us the courage to move forward with these projects. In both instances, without the special assessment, the path of least resistance for firms such as ours and others is to look at new construction, to take a safer direction rather than one fraught with additional risk. But as a person who believes wholeheartedly in historic preservation and the social benefits they accrue, we fully support historic preservation and the special assessment program. Be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Mr. Boutwell, I'd like you to keep your comments to 2 or 3 minutes. We're running out of time.
Okay. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Burr Boutwell, and I'm a constituent of Senator Devlin's, who is also in support of this Senate Bill 192-2. And I'm here as a private property owner. I live in the Gladys Boutwell House. It was built by my grandparents back in 1930. And here speaking essentially on behalf of our family, trying to save our heritage and our history. And we are one of the victims of the recalculation that comes about with Measure 50. We've entered the program in good faith. It was promoted by the state of Oregon, and we strongly support historic preservation. It has helped us preserve and maintain our house. The past 15 years, when our street, there were 6 homes initially on it. Of those 6, now there's 11, and of those 6, only 2 of those homes are pretty much in the original condition, ours in a 1980 colonial-style home. So our street has grown quite a bit. Most of the homes that are on our street are much bigger than ours. They use a lot of the architectural elements and details that our home has. We've kind of set the theme. And so there's definitely been some investment in our neighborhood as a result of us being in the program. Upon exiting the program, we lost our assessed value that was established by Measure 50, and we got recalculated in our taxes, our assessed value in the taxes essentially more than doubled. I'm a little nervous here. We are essentially penalized now into perpetuity with this additional tax burden. And the corrections are correct, and that it needs to be fixed. The program needs to be fixed because it economically, the way it is right now, opposes the public policy that the program was initially set out to do. Simple fairness and common sense argues that we should not be penalized for participating in the program and trying to preserve our heritage and the community heritage and history. We were damaged as an unforeseen consequence of Measure 50, and the unpredictability of the program as it exists right now, there is absolutely no way you can tell where you're going to end up in 15 years, as we are a case. And I guess, our children are the fourth generation in our family home, and we want to continue living there. And it's ironic that the program that's set up to preserve community heritage and history is the program that may essentially take that away from us and our family. So for the sake of preserving our family history, heritage, community history and heritage, we ask that you support Senate Bill 192-2.
Thank you, Mr. Boutwell. You said this is your family home. Would
yes.
you have done something differently with it if it hadn't been for this program?
When I moved into the house in 1990, I actually inherited, my father passed away when I was younger. And had I known what we know now, I would have been probably, the house was really dilapidated when we moved into it. And looking back on it, it would have made more sense at the time to tear it down and start over. I would have been better off. But we've invested a lot of time, effort, sweat equity into it. We love it. The kids love it. I'm glad we did what we did.
Okay.
It's unfortunate we're suffering for it.
I'm not going to ask you for your the personal details of your situation, but if you're willing to meet with me at some time at your convenience to talk about your specific situation, it might help me understand exactly what's going on with the with this assessment. Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay, now we're going to take a couple of opponents here. Ron Morgan and Reese Scholes. And then what we're going to do after these two testify, we are going to recess the public hearing because there's another public hearing where people have come from out of town, and then we will come back for our remaining witnesses if there's time available.
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you. Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. My name is Ron Morgan. I reside in Beaverton. I'm a volunteer with Tax Fairness Oregon. We oppose SB 192 because we believe the special assessment for historic properties should be allowed to sunset. Doing so would provide $13 million in property taxes to local and state governments at a time when each dollar returned to the communities at this point will be spent for today's top priorities. providing services for our most vulnerable citizens, education, and public safety. The special assessment for historic properties was conceived 32 years ago, as an incentive to protect historic properties from destructive alterations and demolition, and it has been successful doing so. But it was intended as an incentive for its time, as policy, not as a permanent entitlement. The special assessment for historic properties was originally enacted in the 70s when historic properties were undervalued as investment assets and were generally perceived to have minimal social benefit. Today, however, historic properties are highly valued both for their social benefit and as assets. The need for an incentive program is no longer compelling as policy. This is reflected in large part by the diminishing number of new applicants. At the same time, we've come to value historic properties as community and market assets. The incentive created by the special assessment for historic properties has lost value as a result of the change to property tax structures wrought by Proposition 50 primarily and others. Many owners of historic properties found that the tax breaks offered by the program no longer penciled out, or that the benefit of a marginal tax break wasn't worth the effort to file rehabilitation and maintenance plans. It mirrored what property owners planned to do anyway. This year, 254 properties are coming off the historic property tax exemption, but so far, not one application has been received, as far as I know. Last year, only 14 applications were received. This is a program that we feel has fulfilled its purpose and needs to sunset. The special assessment for historic properties deliberately created inequities in taxation that were offset by social benefit, by the social benefit of historic preservation. The program educated us and taught us to appreciate and value historic preservation and historic properties, and the program succeeded. However, the program was never intended to be a permanent entitlement. Today, we're designing new programs to help change values and behavior. For example, we're offering special consideration for solar roofs and water preservation. I feel those are the places that we are and should be focusing money and tax exemptions, not here. We ask you to vote no on SB 192. Let the property tax exemption program sunset.
Thank you very much. Mr. Scholes, this is totally unfair because you two are the only opponents, but if you could keep it very short.
thank you, Chair Burdick. I will be very brief because I've had the opportunity to testify before, and I have to tell you, unfortunately, that little has changed since the March 3rd hearing when you heard my spiel. Let me emphasize that Chair Wheeler supports the idea of a historic property tax program, but he believes that it must be efficient and fair. The situation has changed since 1975 when this was first created, and now these exemptions reduce the money that's available for other public services. The Department of Revenue calculates that this reduces public services around the state by about $13 million a year. $10 million of that is in Multnomah County, and that's the reason that I'm here today. Frankly, a lot of the money there is in very high value properties, which I have to say seem to be very different from what we've heard about from the rural areas of the state. It's almost like I'm hearing about two different programs. But I've provided you with a list of some of the places where the money goes from this program. My major point is that the sunset review is the one opportunity that you have as policymakers to make a trade-off in the social benefits. And while certainly there's economic development benefits from preserving historic property, maintaining our schools and maintaining our public safety system is also a public benefit. And what you're asked to do here in deciding on this bill is to decide what is the appropriate balance. Tonight, I'll be presiding over a middle school PTSA meeting where we're going to try and figure out how to make up for the two teachers that we're losing from our school. When I look at some of the luxury condos in the Pearl and I look at losing teachers in the school, I ask what is the balancing? Sunset review is the opportunity that we have to make that balancing. And finally, one thing that you could do to help with this balancing is to do what's been done on other property tax programs, is to give each jurisdiction the option not to review each individual property, but to decide periodically, for example, when the program is scheduled for sunset, set, whether it makes sense to continue for that program to continue in our community. So that is another thing. As has been noted, Multnomah County has proposed language. I've given you a timeline of our involvement. We continue to be available to assist the committee in any way and to continue discussions on this. And I have Randy Walriff here, our assessor, if you have any questions for him. And I'll be done.
Thank you very much, and we will be continuing the conversation. We're not going to move this bill today. We will be continuing the conversation, and as you point out, Multnomah County does have a unique situation here, and the chair takes that very seriously. Thank you both.
Thank you.
There questions from the committee? Thank you. Okay, I'm going to close this. I've got a couple more witnesses to go here, but I'm going to close the public hearing with the intent of reopening it if we have time on Senate Bill 192 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 495.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 495 exempts tangible or intangible property rights, or property interests of Oregon utilities in and related to the Pacific Northwest AC intertie as referenced in certain agreements on property taxation. It applies to tax years beginning on or after date of execution of agreement and tax years beginning on or after July 1, 2009. It takes effect on 91st day following adjournment, sign and die. By the way, in 2005, the legislature enacted a law that exempted from property taxation any intangible and tangible property rights or property interests in and related to Pacific Northwest AC intertie as referenced in a written agreement between the U.S. Department of Energy and a city of any state other than a city in Oregon. The exemption covered out-of-state city-owned utilities without the nexus or physical presence in Oregon that were transmitting access power over the Pacific Northwest AC intertie to geographic areas outside of Oregon. So this bill exempts tangible or intangible property rights, or property interests of Oregon utilities in and related to the Pacific Northwest AC intertie as referenced in certain agreements.
Thank you. We have Sandy Flicker signed up. Even though I don't have a sign-up sheet, I know that she is with company.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker. I'm here representing the Oregon Rural Electric Co-op Association, and thank you very much for your consideration, Madam Chair. We are here today to talk to you about Senate Bill 495, which was a bill printed at our request. And I will give you a little bit of an overview on why we're here to talk to you about this bill, and then I would like for Mr. John Whistler to give you some of the more intimate details on this piece of legislation and the background. And Mr. Zabin Towner is just here to answer questions, so we will be brief.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 495 is a bill about equitable tax treatment. In the 2005 legislative session, a bill was passed, as Mr. Beck indicated, that exempted two municipal utilities that are located in Washington. At the time that was introduced, the discussion had to do with the fact that municipal utilities in Oregon would not be charged an intangible tax on the use of the third AC intertie line, which is owned by Bonneville, that travels through Oregon, goes over Oregon counties. So they were exempt. The bill would have exempted them from paying that tax. As the discussion progressed on the bill, another utility in Washington, a public utility district, asked to be amended into the bill to be exempt from the tax as well. co-ops who are similarly situated, who also pay a tax on this transmission line, which is called a use tax. We have no ownership, direct ownership of the line, but we have a contract with Bonneville for use of the line, and we pay intangible property tax on that line. So we are very similarly situated to those Washington utilities that ended up getting the exemption from that tax. There are out-of-state cooperatives that pay that tax today because we did not get the exemption that was afforded to other out-of-state utilities. So we are back to the legislature once again to ask for equitable tax treatment of consumer-owned utilities in terms of this intangible tax. We do pay property taxes on other properties that we have in Oregon, and the basis that was finally established in the bill that passed in 2005 was the basis of an exemption based on whether you owned any other property in Oregon or not, any other real property. PRC, who we are here on behalf of, which is a group of co-ops, do own some other property in Oregon, and they pay property tax on that property. And we disagree, I guess, with the premise that if you own any other property in Oregon, you should not be exempt from this intangible tax. So we're having a hard time with the nexus between an exemption on paying an intangible property tax and owning real property. We use that transmission line to wheel power, just like the Washington utilities use that transmission line to wheel power, just like other utilities use that transmission line to wheel power across the state of Oregon. There's no difference in how we all use that transmission line. The only difference now is some of us are taxed on the use of that line and some of us are not. So therein lies the basis for Senate Bill 495. A couple of things I wanted to make clear, and that is that we did not initiate exemption legislation in 2005. We only asked to be included in that exemption when additional utilities began to come in asking for exemptions. And since we were similarly situated, we felt it was only fair that we, in fact, are afforded that same exemption. So it wasn't at our initiation originally, but fair is fair. And so since we were not, as I told you, we are now here to ask for equitable tax treatment for electric cooperatives who are paying a tax on that line when other utilities are exempt from the tax on that line. And I want to assure you this isn't a matter of either a large gain or a large loss. The counties are the recipients of this tax money. However, it is only about $70,000 a year spread across the Oregon counties that are involved. So, again, it's not a large gain for us not to pay the tax, and it's not a large loss for the counties to not receive this money. It really is an issue of fair tax policy in Oregon and equitable tax policy in Oregon. And you can you can create any basis you want for an exemption from a tax policy. But at the end of the day, it has to be fair. And so that's what we are here asking for. I'm going to have Mr. Whistler now just give you some more intimate details on Power Resources Cooperative, who is the taxable entity or the taxed entity, and how this tax works.
Okay. If you could identify yourself for the record and be very brief.
I'll be as quick as I can. My name is John Whistler. I'm the Manager of Finance Accounting representing Power Resources Cooperative, headquartered in Portland. I, too, would like to thank the Chair and the Members of the Committee for holding this hearing on Senate Bill 495, which I think, as Sandy has very well stated, is a bill that provides for equitable tax treatment for PRC. We are a not-for-profit generation transmission cooperative. We were formed in 1976 to meet the power supply needs of our member cooperatives, which are 13 member end-use distribution cooperatives, seven of whom serve customers in Oregon, with the other members serving cooperative members in six other states. all of our members are as well not-for-profit consumer-owned utilities serving customers in their local utilities, which are predominantly rural areas. We own two primary assets that we manage on behalf of providing this power supply. One of is a 10% 10% share of the Boardman coal plant in eastern Oregon, and the Coffin Butte Landfill Methane Gas Project, which is a renewable resource located just south of Corvallis. You may have noticed it as you're driving by on Highway 99. It's right next to the Coffin Butte Landfill facility. We also purchased contractual rights, as Sandy has indicated, to use a portion of BPA's AC Intertie to transmit power between the Pacific Northwest and California. We have the right to schedule up to 50 megawatts of power when that amount is available over the Intertie in either direction, and neither PRC or any of our members have an ownership interest in the physical transmission line or other facilities comprising the Intertie. And as Sandy once again indicated, the rights to use the Intertie are similar to a long-term wheeling rights which have been pre-purchased. physical lines or relay facilities which are contained in this contract right are owned, operated, and maintained by the federal government in the persona of Bonneville Power Administration. So since purchasing the rights to use this property, we've had to pay property taxes under regulations adopted by the Oregon Department of Revenue. Historically, this has averaged about $70,000 a year, and for the 2008-09 tax year, equated to approximately $72,000 distributed amongst 13 Oregon counties. This amount becomes an ultimate obligation of our members under their contracts with PRC. In 2005, the Oregon Legislature exempted three out-of-state consumer-owned utilities, much like us, from paying taxes on the respective shares of participation in the AC Intertie. Yet the in-state Power Resources Cooperative members and our members, also consumer-owned utilities, are still required to pay taxes on their share of the Intertie. And we believe this is simply inequitable and discriminatory. Therefore, we do support Senate Bill 495, which would end this discriminatory tax policy, provide that all consumer-owned utilities in Oregon, including PRC, and its Oregon and out-of-state members are given the same tax treatment that other non-Oregon consumer-owned utilities receive related to paying taxes on the BPA-AC Intertie. We believe this is simply a fairness bill that provides equal tax treatment for similarly situated and organized not-for-profit consumer-owned utilities, and I urge the committee to support the bill in its current form. And that's my comments. I can answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much.
I don't know if those details were intimate. That may be a too strong of a term.
Yeah, I was waiting for something kind of racy here. Okay, no questions. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to mention Mr. Beck has an amendment to the bill, which basically is a clarifying amendment. It clarifies that this only applies to electric cooperatives. So there was some language in there about municipal utilities who weren't required to pay it anyway. So there are some clarifying amendments for you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Gil Riddell.
Let myself for a moment, please.
Okay. If you could be very brief.
Yes. Well, I have material there that should be self-explanatory.
Good.
I will breeze through this as quickly as possible, but I need to, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties, I need to first mention to Senator Morris that I'm not wearing green in reaction to OSU Day. It's perfect happenstance that I'm wearing green today. Sorry about that. I'm also authorized to speak for the Special Districts Association of Oregon. The Association of Oregon Counties opposes this bill. It is a new property tax exemption. And as you've heard, one property tax exemption leads to another, which will lead to another. I think you can expect, if you proceed with this, you can expect ultimately the for-profits to come with the same arguments, and you'll have to deal with this again. The issue with respect to Power Resources Cooperative has been decided by the Oregon Tax Court in 1998. This tax is a legal tax, so it in fact is a policy decision for you to make. There isn't any constitutional question involved here. Under Oregon's tax, just to remind you of a couple of points here about the costs of doing this. Under Oregon's rate-based property tax system, a new exemption, deferral, or special assessment doesn't shift the tax burden. It actually costs real revenue for education and public services. Especially during this period of slashing state and local budgets for critical public services, why give away a legal source of public revenue? Statewide, 46% of these property taxes fund education, so this money doesn't go entirely to counties. A large chunk of this will go to education, and the state general fund backfills the loss. The county shares of property taxes help the county fund state-shared services to the same constituents that you have and that the state provides services to. We need revenues to provide these services. We also play a critical role in the public service infrastructure through property tax assessment and collection, and that system is straining. We describe that within the context of Senate Bill 563, which we will visit again with you. The property tax, local property tax administration system is stressed and will get even more stressed, and I'm fearing for the implosion. What we have now is assessment and taxation approved budgets for 08-09 fiscal year at $91.5 million from counties, strapped counties, and only $18.6 million of that comes from the CAFA, the state funding program. The Governor's Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services, at its recommendation number 40, recommends that you fund the Property Tax Expenditure Compensation Fund. It's a law on the books that covers new property tax expenditures and payment of those, 50% of those, to local, the cost to local governments. I'm quoting, local governments bear the brunt of revenue losses when the state enacts new property tax breaks. If you choose to move this forward, the state should comply with the promise to pay 50% of revenues lost to counties, special districts, and cities. And if you've heard from proponents, it's not much. It's only about $70,000. So it would cost the state $35,000 to fund a year to fund this new property tax exemption if you choose to go that direction. And I would like to quote a short-term recommendation from the Task Force on Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring, of which two of you were members. Refrain from new property tax expenditures or state mandates on local governments. This recommendation is directed at the legislature and essentially says do no harm that will make local governments' fiscal situation worse. And then finally, I've attached a familiar a chart that shows the growing gap, annual gap, of expenditures between expenditures for county services and revenues to pay for them. It could grow to some $2 billion a year in fiscal year 2019-2020. So new exemptions, new expenditures are the opposite of helpful. So I thank you for the opportunity to remind you of the costs of this policy choice.
Thank you, Mr. Riddell. Any questions from the committee? We are quickly running out of time, so since our other two neutrals who have some historical perspective on this are usually in the building, I thought I might bring you back when we bring the bill back, if that's agreeable with you. I could be talked out of it, but okay. We are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 495. I apologize for running out of time here. It's not like me at all. Before we proceed, I will announce that we are going to put Senate Bill 62 over till tomorrow, so there'll be no work session on that. And now I'm going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 192 and give the people who are here a chance to testify if they would like. Nicholas Starn, David Barenberg, and Jessica Ingeman.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I see that the clock is ticking, and we'll try not to keep you very long. Dave Barenberg from the City of Portland, and with me is Nicholas Starn, who is also the City of Portland and has run the City's Historic Preservation Program. I will be brief. You've heard a lot of testimony today. City of Portland thinks that this is a critical program in terms of maintaining the character of the City of Portland in terms of preserving our historic
heritage. And if you look around the city, that you can see the value that it has added to the livability and to drawing investment to the city. So it is something that we believe is a critical element, and we'd like to see the program extended. Given the shortness of time, I'd like to stop talking and ask somebody who actually knows more in depth about the program to be able to speak, if I may.
Okay. Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Nicholas Starin. I work for the City of Portland as a city planner. I also had the privilege of serving on the Historic Task Force representing the League of Oregon Cities, although today I'm speaking on behalf of the city, not as a representative of the League of Oregon Cities or the task force. As you heard from several people today, special assessment is an important program around the state, and it is also quite important in the city of Portland. It has played a key role in helping preserve and rehabilitate Portland's historic architectural assets, bringing increased vitality to our neighborhoods and helping to protect and enhance their character. Portland has a significant share of the historic properties that participate in special assessment. I believe it's more than half of the properties statewide that are participating. They range from modest single-family homes in southeast Portland to early 20th century apartment buildings in the Northwest Alphabet Historic District, from large downtown commercial structures to converted schools, converted mortuaries, as you heard, fraternal halls, industrial buildings. Although the number of properties that participate in the program in the city fluctuates every year, the recent trend has been downward. In 2006, there were 425 properties in Portland in the program. This year, there are 293. In the past 5 years, 105 Portland properties have entered the program, while over the next 5 years, 122 will exit. Over several decades, historic special assessment has been effective in helping to preserve and rehabilitate the historic fabric that makes Portland such a livable and human-scaled city. There are a number of wonderful examples of properties that have taken advantage of the program and that continue to enrich Portland's urban environment. You heard quite a few of them today, so I'm going to be very brief and just mention two that weren't mentioned. The first is the Harrison Court Apartments buildings, which are near Portland State University. It's a three-story wood frame building, a remnant of Old South Portland. It's sort of a unique building. It has two separate portions of the building that have separate entrances. It was designed for one part of the building to be for female occupants and the other for male occupants. It entered the historic special assessment in 2006. Assessment helped support some renovation work on the building and have helped keep the building in economic use in an area that's experiencing quite a bit of redevelopment pressure and an area where the underlying zoning entitlements are very significant, and it would encourage that building to be demolished as a significantly larger building could be put there. The other example I would mention is the Hibernian Hall, which is in northeast Portland in the Elliott neighborhood, a former Irish-American community building. Some dedicated entrepreneurs, with the support of their neighborhood association and the help of special assessment, rehabilitated this hard-to-reuse special-purpose building, and now it's the Winter Ballroom with a music and a cultural event venue, a restaurant, and an art gallery. And it has spurred the redevelopment, catalyzed redevelopment of adjacent historic buildings, and encouraged additional investment in this once largely neglected corner of the neighborhood.
Can you summarize if you have any recommendations or something?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'll reiterate. I just reiterate the program has been good for Portland. It's had tangible public benefits, including preserving our heritage and economic development effects. And I would urge the legislature to pass some legislation this session that continue the program.
And you support the -2 amendment?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Close the public hearing. Again, I apologize for running out of time. We are adjourned.